Good morning. On today's programme, Estonia asserts its sense of identity at its National Song and Dance Festival, and the Arch Steel Bridge making headlines in the Czech capital Prague. But first we go to China, where house prices have dropped significantly in recent years, sparking a slowdown in consumer spending and confidence. This housing crisis, along with increasing job insecurity, has meant that Chinese people are simply not spending as much as their government would like them to. Mark Godfrey has this report.
Cycling my bike through Beijing this week, I thought back to over a decade ago, when these streets were lined with cranes and with giant billboards seeped in images of new apartments framed with impossibly blue skies and green lawns. I recalled young Americans, English teachers I knew, who made good money wearing ill-fitting suits and playing investors in promotional photos and videos made by property developers seeking to project an international status. Musicians and catering companies did well too, from the constant launch parties for new developments. Beijing these days seems silent by contrast, with little in the way of loud construction noise, and no one approached me at a subway stop with a leaflet for a new apartment development. That's because China's massive real estate boom is over, after several decades of construction and rising prices. Home sales are down, and average prices for homes are down 30% in the past 2 years at a development my friend Zhang bought into in 2010. "We're still in the black," said my friend. "It's worth more than we paid for it." But he's worried that the price will fall more. "Then we're in trouble," he told me. Government wants consumer spending to rescue the economy, to rebalance it from a long-time over-reliance on the construction industry for tax revenue. But the fall in real estate values tempers local enthusiasm for shopping, and worries about future health and welfare also suppress any appetite for spending. Zhang and his wife are teachers and are comfortable, but there's no holidays, no extravagances. Their savings are in a bank account. Government would like them to spend those savings, but Zhang is holding fire. "Why would I spend?" he asks, as we drink scented green tea from his home province of Shandong. "The economy is bad, and if I get sick and lose my job, I will have medical bills to pay," he says. Zhang's is a universal dilemma in modern China, where the fall in home prices has intensified debate over the merits of the residency registration system introduced in the time of Mao Zedong. This system ties a citizen to the place where they were born. Even though my friend Zhang has lived and taught most of his life in Beijing, he's from a small city on the east coast. His hukou or residency card tie him to there. That means he's only entitled to the social welfare or public health care available in his hometown, which is a fraction of what's available to somebody with a Beijing residency card. So that Zhang's apartment isn't just a place to live. It's also insurance in old age. It's their social welfare cushion. The slow deflation of house prices has also hurt another of my longtime Beijing friends, Mr. Gao, but his story is better because he's a Beijing native. If he gets sick, the local social security fund will cover his bills in a decent hospital. Gao is a retired businessman from a proud Beijing family, son of a government official who served Mao and Deng Xiaoping. He too has taken a hit from the falling property prices, but he's more relaxed about social services, and he's not enthusiastic about reforming the residence permit system. "Beijing is full," he said. "Yes, there are 20 million people here, but wouldn't the abolition of the residency permit system make you rich?" I asked. "Lots more people would want to come to Beijing and property prices would rise." "And how would we pay for them? Our hospitals and schools would be overwhelmed," said Gao. I tried to counter by offering that more spending on social services across the country would alleviate that problem. "People would stay put," I suggested. "China can't afford to create a Western-style welfare state," my friend Gao said. And then we were off on another conversation about the merits of welfare states. Later, as I pedaled home from a dinner at the Zhang's, I thought of the conundrum facing China and those days when every corner of Beijing seemed to be a building site. Near Chaoyang Park, I saw something I didn't expect. An apartment complex was being leveled, not for a new high-rise, but to make way for a park. A billboard announced the park as one of several such projects to make Beijing more elegant, not more populated. Property prices may be down, but something tells me China is in no rush to change the residency permit system anytime soon. For World Report, this is Mark Godfrey in Beijing.
To Estonia next. Earlier this month, the country celebrated its national song and dance festival. It's one of the largest choral events in the world, with over 40,000 performers taking part. The festival happens every 3 to 5 years. This year's is the first since Russia invaded Ukraine, heightening the significance of this celebration of Estonian national identity. Tanya Sillam sent this report from Tallinn.
This year was the first national song and dance festival since Russia invaded Ukraine. And for that reason, the celebration of national identity took on added significance. Estonia, the most northerly of the Baltic states, shares its entire eastern border with Russia. Apart from a few years after the First World War, Estonia has only been independent since 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and it's felt the resurgence of Russian imperial ambitions keenly. This nation of only 1.3 million people has a history of subjugation by its neighbours. It was occupied by the Soviet Union in 1940, then Nazi Germany, then again by Moscow. Its people have been subjugated by Poland, Sweden and Denmark, but it was as a province of the Russian Empire that a sense of national awareness emerged in the second half of the 19th century. Much like the Gaelic Revival, language was central to identity. In Estonia, it was expressed through song. And so it was that I found myself one of 90,000 people at the 28th National Song and Dance Festival in Tallinn. This year, even as parts of Europe baked in a heat wave, it was pouring with rain in Estonia. The parade set off at 2 p.m. along a 5 km route to the festival grounds, past the old KGB hotel where we stood with crowds of bedraggled but enthusiastic onlookers waving Estonian flags. Supplies of plastic ponchos sold out early, and it seemed that everyone had come prepared. Well, almost everyone. Sodden performers played, waltzed and sang their way past, each group dressed in the folk costume of their village, town or province. There was finely worked linen, felt shirts and waistcoats embroidered with parish patterns. The women wore skirts woven in fine vertical stripes of colour and ubiquitous red lipstick. There were high headdresses worthy of bishops, thick garlands of oak and light crowns of cornflowers. One teenager told me proudly that her grandmother had made hers. And these are indeed the creations of generations of Estonians. The songs and dances are those of the ancestors. Estonians remained pagan until the Northern Crusades in the 12th century. The indigenous population from the Baltic Sea to Novgorod were forcibly baptized under the Teutonic Knights. What remains of their castles are now tourist attractions, with the huge Tampere Castle dominating the ancient medieval streets of Old Tallinn. It was said that at this time, Estonian warriors sang epic poems before battle. And these runic songs of pagan ritual, the call and response, are a vital part of the song tradition. And so too are modern compositions, and especially those of the great Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, whose 90th birthday falls this year. Inspired by Gregorian chant, his mystical choral works were banned for a period under Soviet rule. So too the Estonian national anthem and its flag. It was 7 o'clock, or 5 hours after it had begun, that the end of the parade reached the festival grounds. The symbolic festival torch, which had made its way across the country, flickered, and we held our breath. And then the conductor's baton came down and 30,000 voices filled the air. Estonia considers itself a frontline state. The Russian fortress of Ivangorod marks the limit of NATO's eastern flank, just 2 hours' drive from Tallinn. Estonians say once the fighting stops in Ukraine, Russia will turn its attention once again to the Baltic states. Last year, under Prime Minister Kaja Kallas, now the EU's foreign policy chief, Estonia donated nearly 1% of its GDP to the Ukrainian war effort. The Russian embassy in Tallinn, closed after demonstrations, sits behind riot fencing draped with anti-Putin posters. Down the road, tourists can visit the old KGB cells, in which political prisoners were tortured and killed. 10% of the population was deported to Siberia, including the mother and grandmother of Kaya Kallas. During the last years of Soviet rule, the Song Festival grounds became the site of mass protest. It became known as the Singing Revolution. The ancient Estonian language, of which the Song Festival is a celebration, is related to Finnish. It's ironic, then, that in a third of Estonian homes, what's called the home language is actually Russian. The government says all Estonians, whatever their ethnicity, are celebrated. And nowhere more than the Song Festival. After years of rehearsing, the final performance is exciting and visibly emotional. At one point, veteran conductor 88-year-old Neymar Järvi became airborne and fell off stage, requiring a hospital stay. Muisama on Minuarm, my fatherland is my love, they sang, my sacred Estonia. This unofficial anthem was written in 1944 as the Soviets threatened invasion. It confirms, say Estonians, that we exist. For World Report, this is Tanya Sillam in Tallinn.
Finally, we go to Prague, which is often hailed as Europe's best preserved capital, 1,000 years of architecture in one walkable city. Most visitors make a beeline for the 14th century Charles Bridge, but there's another bridge making the headlines now, the Vyšehrad Railway Bridge. This arch steel structure has been part of the city's southern skyline for more than 100 years, but now it's under threat, as Rob Cameron reports.
Prague is a city of spires, cobblestones and history, spared the widespread destruction of World War II that scarred so many other European cities. It's a living tableau of architectural styles, from Gothic to Baroque, industrial to modern. Few, if any, tourists leave the city without walking over the ancient flagstones of the Charles Bridge. But a few kilometres further south is a different bridge, one without buskers or crowds of tourists, but plenty of tension in the steel. You've probably never heard of the Vyšehrad Railway Bridge, and that's kind of the point. It's not graceful or gothic, and it won't win any Instagram beauty contests, but for 123 years, this rusty arched hulk of riveted steel has carried trains from the main station to points westward, to spa towns like Karlovy Vary, beer towns like Pilsen, and even onwards to Germany. But after more than a century, this iconic industrial structure, designed by the Austro-Hungarian engineer who created the copy of the Eiffel Tower on Petrine Hill, is showing its age. The railway authority, which owns the bridge, says 70% of the steel is rusted beyond repair and fatigue cracks are beginning to appear. The only solution, they say, is to dismantle the bridge and erect a modern replacement, a tasteful replica not dissimilar to the original, but one better suited to the demands of 21st century rail traffic. The new bridge will have a third rail and will be part of a wider renovation effort of the surrounding area. The existing bridge will be taken apart and moved upstream to start a new life as a pedestrian and cyclist bridge in the countryside just outside Prague. It's a plan that faces fierce opposition. For a group of architects, engineers, politicians and locals, the Vyšehrad Railway Bridge is more than a collection of rusty beams and bolts. It's part of the cultural fabric of the city, and UNESCO, which keeps a close eye on changes to the Czech capital, agrees. Over 25,000 people have also signed a petition. Opponents have commissioned a study carried out by Swiss and British engineers who argue that only 15% of the steel is so corroded it needs replacing. The rest, they say, can be saved. The bridge could serve for another 100 years if given the care it deserves. So what started as an infrastructure project has become a battle for the soul of Prague, symbolic of the wider struggle between preservation and progress that's taking place all over the world. In a city where architecture is cherished as a national treasure, the debate over the Visegrad Bridge strikes a deep chord. But ultimately, the final decision may rest not with engineers or with conservationists, but with the Czech cabinet. With elections due in the autumn and a change of government likely, the only question now is which government that will be. Until then, the old bridge still carries its burden: trains, time, and now the weight of public affection. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.